You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we look at one of the most famous artworks by an early 20th century artist that has become newly famous for, of all things, the Nazis' tendency to steal his work. Gustav Klimt outraged the Habsburg establishments at the turn of the 20th century and was the darling of the Viennese intellectual scene for his beautiful portraits and his daring erotic drawings. My guest today has written an account of perhaps his most famous artwork, The Lady in Gold, the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, a stunning work known as the Viennese Mona Lisa, a beautiful Jewish woman covered in a gold leaf painting, a woman literally swirled in gold. The painting has had a remarkable history. It was plundered by the Nazis, held after the war as an Austrian treasure. The artwork was the subject of a decade-long lawsuit to return the painting to its heirs. The eventual disposition of that case has opened a floodgate of the questionable ownership or provenance of many works in some of the world's greatest museums, including those in the United States. Anne-Marie O'Connor has written about this remarkable artwork in her book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. O'Connor was a foreign correspondent for Reuters and a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times for 12 years and has written extensively on the Klimt painting and the Bloch-Bauer's family's efforts to recover its art collection. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Anne-Marie O'Connor, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
You know, when you hear about a book about a story of a painting, that doesn't sound like a real interesting story at first glance for most people. But this particular painting, first of all, for people who have seen it, and I've only seen reproductions of it, it's still an amazing painting. And it has this incredibly rich history of a little over 100 years. The portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, which was done in gold leaf. You've been following the restitution story. When did you realize this would become a book?
You know, this is the story of a painting society woman that somehow became an arrow to the future. It embodies turn-of-the-century Vienna and the art of Gustav Klimt, and it somehow became freighted with the terrible legacy that Austrians call the burden of history. When I first stumbled across this, I actually wasn't aware of its importance. I was reading the West Side Weekly in Los Angeles, a community paper, in mid-2001, and there was a column by Bob Scheer about a neighborhood woman in her 80s, and her name was Maria Altman. The Nazis had stolen a painting of her aunt. The painting wasn't locked away somewhere in a mysterious, unknown place. It was in the National Museum with other paintings her family owned. The column had a tiny image of the painting, and I just looked at it, and I thought, that painting? It was one of Gustav Klimt's wealthy, decadent society women, or so I had been led to believe in art history class years before. And I called 411, and an older woman answered, Maria Altman with an old world accent. And she invited me over and made me Viennese coffee with lots of whipped cream and told me a very long story about her Aunt Adele, a woman of today living in the world of yesterday. And according to Maria, the woman in the golden painting and a number of the other women painted by Klimt were not decadent society women at all. They were art collectors, art patrons, intellectuals, existentialists, women who supported Freud, modern art, and modernism itself.
This is what's really interesting is you tell the story of Klimt, who is breaking through all sorts of taboos and barriers in turn-of-the-century Vienna. He's painting women who are reveling in their sexuality. And at a time when you look at the other artists of the period, like Kees van Dongen and Alexei Yavlensky, they're almost ugly images of women. He is drawing these exquisite portraits, drawings of women. And this was breaking all sorts of taboos in Vienna at the time.
Well, you know, he was drawn to women who wanted to live differently and feel differently and dress differently. These were the kind of women who wanted to be more when their societies wanted them to be less. One of the women in this milieu wanted to be a doctor. There'd never been a graduate of the Vienna Medical School. They got her in dressed as a man, and there were so many jeers and boos, they called security, but she did become the school's first female graduate. So this milieu was filled with these women who were trying to do something a little different, and this is how Klimt was himself. He was from a very poor family. He wanted to make a different kind of more innovative art. He wanted to join the modern art progression that was going on in the rest of the European capitals. And he was naturally drawn towards personalities like him. Now, interestingly, he was drawn towards women who were unique, but he also approached them as equals. And you can see this in his paintings. The paintings are very psychological. These are not women as wives or as daughters. These are women who are individuals themselves. And this was the age of the individual with the evolution of Freud. So he had a symbiotic relationship with very interesting women, and I think that really affected his art.
It's really interesting when you look at the rest of his art, when you look at his landscapes, it looks very much of that period of the 20th century. But when you look at his paintings of women, they're very idealized and very out of style with other artists.
Well, he was very influenced by Cézanne and by Sargent Singer. Klimt, one of the things that allowed Klimt not to be called a degenerate by the Nazis when they declared degenerate artists, was that Klimt was an excellent draftsman. He could actually, from a child, draw things exactly the way they were. And this made him be drafted into a lot of different commissions when he was a boy. And when he was a boy, an adolescent in his mid-teens, he was really too poor to go to school because he didn't have the proper clothes. So he went to art school, and he immediately got a lot of commissions because of this great gift. Now, it was also kind of a burden to him, because he also wanted to innovate as an artist. And I think in these portraits, he managed to achieve both.
Yes, and of course, for those who have not seen The Lady in Gold, it is a portrait of, again, Adele Bloch-Bauer, a young wife, and her dress is just this kaleidoscope of gold-looking, they're just patterns, just a beautiful, beautiful variations on gold. There's gold leaf all over the painting. How did this particular painting come to be?
In 1903, Ferdinand Bloch-Bauer, Adele's husband, commissioned the portrait. Now, Adele probably already knew Klimt because her best friend, Alma Mahler, had had a romance with Klimt. It never went anywhere because Alma Mahler's stepfather ran Klimt off because he knew he probably wouldn't marry her. So Adele certainly knew Klimt at this time. But her husband commissioned a Klimt portrait, and he first went to Ravenna, the Byzantine capital in what is now Italy. And he looked at the mosaics in Ravenna, and there were mosaics of Justinian and Theodora, and most art historians believe that he got his inspiration from the mosaic of Empress Theodora, who was actually sort of an advocate of women and was able to put protections for women in Justinian law, which is a foundation of Western law. But she was this very unusual woman. She was a single mother when she met Justinian. He married her and made her an extremely powerful empress. And eventually she was made a saint. And they left these beautiful, beautiful mosaics that are just colorful and resplendent and catch the light in a really transcendent way. And if anyone has ever been to Ravenna, these mosaics have a strong impact on the viewer. And he walked through this hall of 7th century mosaics and was just overwhelmed by the color and the dazzling light. And that is supposed to be the model of his portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer.
And again, you see these sort of mosaic patterns all throughout the painting. The decision to use gold leaf, that was kind of unusual. And, of course, that's the reason why it sort of is one of the reasons it's so notorious today, this painting.
Well, anyone who's been to Vienna can see what informed that decision. Vienna, everything in Vienna is gold or at least gilded. Heroes hold golden globes. Armor and spears are tinged in a golden color on statues. The statue of Johann Strauss in the Composer's Park is all gold.
Yeah.
It's just a city that where gold has been used for hundreds of years by the Habsburgs to signify imperial power and immortality and importance. And so this bled into his art early on. In the late 1800s, he started to use gold in some of his paintings of Athena and different heroic figures that he painted. And then when he moved into other arts in his the most vigorous time of his life, he started to use gold in his prime. This was his primal color for the Kiss, for the Beethoven frieze, for some of his most important paintings. And he was also influenced by Egyptian motifs. In those days, a lot of people collected Egyptian antiquities in Vienna, including Freud. So all these motifs made their way into his art with this gold that has actually been used by many cultures to signify transcendence and immortality.
And of course, the figure of the face, she has this wonderful enigmatic look on her face, which also gives the picture some power.
Well, they call it the Austrian Mona Lisa because of that. It's a very modern, much more sensual Mona Lisa. But the face is interesting because some people credit Gustav Klimt with inventing the modern siren. In other words, that floating face with the look of longing, the upturned eyes, the yearning, the hint of sensuality. A lot of people say he invented the siren before silent films.
Hmm. Well, it is a gorgeous painting. But other than that, what really makes this book is the incredible history this painting has. After the painting was finished, it hung in the Blockbauer home for a number of years. You bring in a young house painter from who was in Vienna at that particular time, who probably had to know who Klimt was. That was Adolf Hitler. And of course, when Hitler came to power and began expanding his empire to Austria and the Anschluss, this painting now has a new history, doesn't it?
Well, at the time that the painting was being created, Hitler was in Vienna. He was trying to eke out a living as an artist. He was trying to get into the Art Academy. He was rejected twice. He was making these kind of tepid watercolors that a kindly framer, a Jewish framer, persuaded some of his clients to buy them. But his artistic career wasn't really going anywhere. But he was sort of finding his identity in some of the hate language of the time. And strangely, what launched this painting into the future in such a dynamic way was that Klimt, many of the intellectual women that he painted, were Jewish. Because at the time, the aristocracy had much more conventional roles for women. They were much more circumscribed. They didn't play as active a role in public life in general. But in this milieu that he gravitated towards, a lot of the intellectual bohemian women were Jewish. So that was sort of an interesting coincidence at the turn of the century. But later it became a decisive characteristic of these paintings when the Nazis came in, because a lot of the portraits were Jewish women and a lot of the landscapes were collected by Jewish collectors who had been patrons of modern art at the turn of the century. And that is what propelled Klimt's body of art into history.
It's interesting that Klimt really, you know, the Nazis weren't high on expressionists, but Klimt was perhaps the exception.
It's interesting because when they declared the list of degenerate artists, some people even today are still surprised that he was not included on it. It had everyone from Kokoschka, Picasso, virtually every important modern artist, excepting Klimt. And probably Balder von Schirach, the Nazi governor of Vienna, was decisive in this. He had a slightly more flexible view of art, but he also really personally admired Klimt. And Klimt could be seen, because of his excellent draftsmanship, his art could be seen as reflecting Germanic values. And also, he could be seen with his virility and his good looks as kind of a German Übermensch that the Nazis celebrated. Now, there was one technical problem with Klimt's paintings in using them as icons of Nazi Vienna. The sophisticated, elegant society women that they wanted to exhibit in all these exhibition halls happened to be Jewish.
Yeah.
And Klimt was known to be philo-Semitic. In other words, he had a lot of Jewish friends. So what they did was they changed the names of all the paintings. They made the names descriptive. When the Belvedere, the National Gallery, first acquired the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, it appeared in a book. And of course, they couldn't give her name because she'd been very prominent. But the writer of the book actually knew her. And so he just called it the painting Dom in Gold.
Yes,
Lady in Gold. And that is what happened to all of these Klimt paintings. They were rebranded with anonymous titles and put out there by the Nazis in major exhibitions. In fact, the biggest exhibition ever of Klimt's work was in 1943 in Vienna under Balder von Schrock.
My guest today is Anne-Marie O'Connor, who is a contributor for The Washington Post. She has been following the story of the restitution of the portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer for over 10 years and writing her new book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer. She joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. We haven't really talked much about Ferdinand Bloch Bauer, but he becomes the central figure because Adele died fairly young. And he is there in the 1930s when the Reich and a gentleman named Ernst Fuhrer, of all people, takes an interest in his paintings. And he owns a number of Klimts as well.
Well, Ferdinand was extremely prominent then. He was the president of the sugar industry. He was a major philanthropist. He was celebrated in society columns and extolled for his patronage of art and culture, and had reached a position of prestige. And in fact, one of the art historians who solicited his help in art exhibitions and other things eventually came back to his mansion to steal his art. But what happened right before the Nazi takeover was Ferdinand Bloch Bauer financed a retrospective of an expressionist artist who was then the most prominent artist alive in Austria, Oskar Kokoschka. And the exhibition went up in Vienna, and it was a huge society event, and everyone went. But right at the height of the exhibition in 1937, the Nazis declared Kokoschka and many other artists in Europe degenerate artists and ordered his paintings to be pulled down from the walls of German museums. And hundreds and hundreds and eventually thousands and thousands of paintings were pulled down from museums in Germany. And this is something that worried Ferdinand very much, because he was more concerned than the rest of his family that Hitler was an immediate threat to them in Austria. The rest of the family was concerned about Hitler, of course, and thought his rise to power was terrible. But they were getting on with their lives and getting married and falling in love, and they were very happy people. And Ferdinand was a widower living alone and had more time to think and was much more attuned to his concerns about what was going on in Germany. So when this occurred, Ferdinand extended the art exhibition indefinitely to try to defy the German edict about degenerate artists. And when the exhibition closed, not too long after Hitler came in, since he had been such a great patron of art and his art collections had been photographed and admired by so many experts in Austria, they knew exactly where to find everything he had. Everyone who he had helped in the past, not everyone, but many of them, marched into the house and said, okay, we want this painting, we want this painting, we want this for this museum. They knew exactly where to find it.
And basically, they just took everything.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, or rather sadly, some of the same art historians and museum directors who he had helped very much in the past as a philanthropist, because he believed in supporting art, not just as a collector going out and buying it, but supporting the development of modern art by giving enough financing to nurture artists and support their development.
And of course, Nazis come in, they take the paintings, they put them in the galleries. Many of these paintings would be the core of what Adolf Hitler hoped would be the Führer Museum in Linz, Austria, which would be a huge, keep in mind, was it about 20% of the art in Europe had been looted by the Nazis? Is that a pretty...
That's correct. 20% of the paintings of the art in general in Europe was stolen under Hitler. What happened was some of the most brilliant art historians in Austria immediately were recruited and agreed to work for this collecting process of the Nazis. There were a number of things happening with his paintings. One was they were curating for the Führer Museum in Linz, which was Hitler's dream. As a failed artist, now he would come back and be and dictate artistic taste. So they were collecting for that. They were also collecting art to sell because they could finance Hitler's war machine. They may not have known that at the time, but that was part of the plan. The shakedown of wealthy Viennese citizens who happened to be Jewish was to use their possessions, not just art but jewelry, to finance the war machine. And then the other thing that was very, very important at that time is that a lot of the Nazi leadership would bond by giving each other works of art, because art was one of Hitler's conceits. So they also shared in this kind of culture of art acquisition, really theft, and they gave each other paintings as gifts. So a number of the paintings in Ferdinand's mansion, particularly the more traditional art that he liked, much more than his wife Adele, the Waldmüller and other more traditional painters, were given as gifts between the Nazis, because for the Nazis, Klimt was a little modern. Right. So they gravitated more towards the more conventional painters in Ferdinand's collection. And actually, they didn't keep the Klimt paintings. They gave them, the Nazi administrator handed them out to museums. Gustav Klimt had one of his illegitimate sons had become a Nazi filmmaker. And with the help of Baldur von Schirach, he went around Vienna buying up his father's paintings that had been stolen from Jewish collections. And he also got some of the paintings in the Blockbauer collection.
And of course, after the war, these paintings just ended up in the museums and stayed there through the 1990s. Austria basically made the decision that restitution really couldn't take place. Too much had happened since then, and they just wouldn't even look at restitution. These became treasures of the people. And it was, again, Maria Altman and a grandson of the composer Arnold Schoenberg, who finally takes up the battle of getting the family back their pictures. And this was a huge 10-15 year battle.
It was an 8-year battle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, after the war in Austria, what happened in Austria stayed in Austria. People papered over their backgrounds. A man named Kurt Waldheim ran for president and said he spent the war years at university, and no one really questioned his story. And then what happened was a younger generation of Austrians started to come of age, and one of them was a count named Hubertus Czernin, a very modern young count. And he became an investigative journalist, and he uncovered Waldheim's background and made a big scandal there in the 1980s. And then he turned his investigations to the art in the museums, because the paintings were ubiquitous and everybody looked at them all the time. But he had heard that there were stories behind them that had not been told. And in those days, the archives were locked. But he got people to get into the archives and helped him get information on these paintings. And he started to focus on a painting of a beautiful woman with a family that had been very prominent, apparently, but that he'd never heard of. And he looked through the paperwork and found that the painting had been delivered to the museum in 1941 with a letter saying Heil Hitler, and that the story that people had been told about the acquisition of that painting was wrong. And when his journalistic work came out, Maria Altman and Randall Schoenberg, the grandson of the composer, who had actually been declared a degenerate himself in Germany, started to focus on trying to uncover the stories behind these paintings and get them back.
Yeah. And of course, you know, now we're seeing the floodgates open, but really it was these law cases that sort of help open the floodgates of who really owns a lot of the arts in museums, not only in Europe, but in here in America as well.
Well, before this case, it was very difficult to get back a painting that had been stolen in the Nazi era. Since this case began, 12 Klimt masterpieces were stolen by their owners under Nazi rule have been returned by Austrian museums to their heirs. In a wave of art restitutions that have just roiled Austria, because regardless of whether people really felt that the Blockbauer collection should be returned, all of these paintings had stories, and all of these stories raised moral questions. And after this case began, no one could really look at these paintings the same way again, because there were other stories behind other Klimt paintings of women that were very disturbing in many cases. And it just changed Austria's relationship to the past in a significant way, because Austrians really love their art. And they had been looking at these paintings their entire lives. And suddenly they heard these very strange stories that maybe are not as important as the history of a president, but for Austrians, were very eye-opening.
Well, in many ways it was, because a president is one person, but a painting that has a connection to the country, to the heritage of the country, you know, it's multi-generational.
Well, these paintings are very talismanic. They're almost, someone in Vienna described them as, their effect is sort of Freudian, because they're symbols that people have looked at all of their lives. And for them to learn that some of these handmaidens of modernism in these paintings, who were some of the creators of the modernist culture of turn-of-the-century Vienna that is now widely celebrated, to hear that these women were perhaps sent to camps or persecuted in different ways was a very difficult lesson. It was, in some ways, a fabulous educational experience. It was very difficult for them to lose their paintings. They considered these paintings patrimony.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you have the reaction of Austrian authorities who, as you mentioned earlier, said they lament the loss of the Austrian Mona Lisa and other paintings, and really lament the fact that these are not going to people who love the art necessarily. They're going to people who are going to sell them, and they're going to end up, as they would say, you know, locked away from the people. And they kind of look at these paintings as having sort of a public ownership. And it's interesting that they can't reconcile the fact that they were taken forcibly.
They consider these paintings cultural property. But history and understanding of history is also cultural property. Of course, it was very difficult to lose these from public view. There are paintings that are sold every night at Christie's that really would be better in the public eye. But there really wasn't much of an alternative at that point, because stolen property on the walls of art museums is not a good expression of patrimony. So it was a difficult, lamentable occurrence for them, but I think that the lesson that was learned through this process was also of incalculable value. And the Austrians seem to have made their peace with the restitution of the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer that is now hanging in the Neue Gallery in New York.
And, of course, that's the great irony, that it is in a public collection today. I mean, it's a privately owned collection, but it's publicly viewable.
Well, you could argue that that painting in Austria actually was not displayed properly. It was not displayed with its history. Now its history is known. But I would say that the Austrians have made their peace somewhat with that particular painting, perhaps because it is on public view. And the reason I think that is because they are celebrating now the year of Gustav Klimt in Austria with many exhibitions and events, and they issued a commemorative 50-euro coin to go along with the exhibition. It's a beautiful coin. On one side of the coin is the face of Gustav Klimt, and on the other side of the coin is the face of Adele Bloch-Bauer. And I thought that was very significant, because they could have chosen the kiss as a symbol, or something else as a symbol of Klimt's women. But instead, they showed this painting that had been restituted in a spectacular restitution case that actually made Gustav Klimt more famous than he had ever been.
Well, it's an interesting book that tells the history of Vienna during Klimt's time, the story of the family who owned the portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, the Nazi occupation, the story afterwards of the lost property, and, of course, the restitution. The name of the book is The Lady in Gold. Anne-Marie O'Connor, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anne-Marie O'Connor speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her book, The Lady in Gold, is published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.